Hello and welcome. My name is Richard Taverner and I am your host of Any Further Questions. You are listening to episode 9 of season 2. If you don't already know, all episodes of Any Further Questions are available to listen to on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, so please do go and check them out now. Joining me today is Professor Francesca Happe to answer as many unanswered questions as we can in the time we are allowed. On the 28th of February, Francesca gave a lecture, Changes in the Concept of Autism. It is available to watch on our YouTube channel, and so for context, it's probably a good idea to go and watch that before you listen to us. Francesca is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience, King's College London. She has received numerous awards and written books on the subject of autism for the past 30 years, and in 2021, she was awarded a CBE for her services to the study of autism. On the 28th of February, Francesca gave a lecture, Changes in the Concept of Autism. Francesca, welcome. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Nice to be here.
Good to have you. We're going to start by a question from one of our audience. We had close to 100 questions from our audience after the lecture and during the lecture, so it was incredibly popular. And our first question is, do you believe that we are overdiagnosing the prevalence of ASD, or are we finally diagnosing the correct proportion of the population and helping those in need?
It's a really good question, and it's a hard one to answer because autism is a behavioural diagnosis, so we don't have anything to check it against. We can't look for a marker in the blood or something like that. The latest data from the UK, looking over the last 10 or so years, suggests that the big rise in diagnoses have been first diagnoses in adulthood after the age of 18 and diagnoses among women and girls. And the authors of that study suggest this shows that we're catching up on people we've historically missed rather than overdiagnosing. But there are some figures coming out from some studies around the world coming up to something like 3%. Of the population meeting diagnostic criteria. And there one might ask, where are the boundaries between being on the spectrum but not warranting a diagnosis and having autism spectrum disorder as we currently understand it? And one of the distinctions is that to get the diagnosis, strictly speaking, your traits should be impairing to you in everyday life. And that might be an impairment because your environment doesn't suit your neurotype, your way of thinking, but there really should be an impairment. And I think sometimes the diagnosis is going beyond that to people who are functioning actually very well in life, but do have a lot of autistic traits. And whether or not we should use the diagnosis for that part of the spectrum, I think, is up for debate.
How important is it for autism to be diagnosed early in life? Is there evidence base showing the impacts benefits of an early diagnosis?
The evidence is mainly cross-sectional rather than longitudinal, but there is an association between later diagnosis and worse mental health, for example. So it does seem that earlier diagnosis is better. Apart from anything else, it allows people self-understanding and understanding from people around them that they're not just being difficult or naughty, but they are genuinely processing the world in a different way from neurotypical people. So earlier does seem to be better.
We had a group of questions focusing particularly on children, and I'm going to group them all together now. Thank you for all your questions, by the way. I had to only pick a group of them as we didn't have time to get through every single one. The next question we had was, we require a level of disability in order to give an autism diagnosis. This seems at odds with the idea that autism per se is not disabling. How do we square?
I think that we've moved over time from a medical model of disability, where we would have thought of autism as disabling in itself, to a more social model of disability, where the disability arises from the mismatch between the traits and needs and strengths and weaknesses of the individual and the environment they're in. And most environments are designed by neurotypical people, and the demands that they place on autistic people can effectively disable them in the same way as if you don't have ramps, somebody who's using a wheelchair is disabled. The diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder requires impairment, as I mentioned, and so that does mean that in our current environment, the way that you function is difficult for you. So your social communication differences are actually disabling. They're making it harder for you to get a job, to keep a job, for example, to make friends, to keep friends. So I think that it is possible to hold a neurodiversity viewpoint where the differences are valued and not stigmatized, while recognizing that in the current world, autism is disabling. The other thing is that, of course, the things that go with autism, intellectual disability, epilepsy, stigma, bullying and so on, those are all disabling as well. And for an individual, you can't always disentangle what's part of the autism and what's part of, say, society's response to the autism.
If someone has a history of extensive childhood trauma and or neglect, this often leads to autism being missed. Do you have thoughts about overcoming this?
That's a really interesting question. It's true that in our current services, things are sort of siloed into neurodevelopmental services for those who are thought to be born with a different neurotype, and services for children who have experienced abuse or neglect or other adverse circumstances where their differences in functioning are seen to be a result of their environment. And of course, that dichotomy is completely artificial because it doesn't recognize that you can be born with a different neurotype and experience all kinds of adversity in life, and that your outcome at any one time is a product of both things, your inherent traits and personality and characteristics and what you experience throughout life. So I think it's absolutely true that we are taking, generally people are taking a simplistic attitude that it's one or the other rather than thinking it may very well be both. And we do know that autistic children are at greater risk of experiencing adverse circumstances and adverse life events, as are autistic adults as well. A lot of our work has been around PTSD and trauma in autism and the fact that autism itself predisposes to developing poor mental health after traumatic events, some of which neurotypical people wouldn't consider traumatic. So I think it's absolutely true that for child services too, we need to be thinking in a joined up way about neurodiversity and adverse life circumstances.
So leading on from that, you can be born with autism and then that autism can be exacerbated by trauma throughout your lifetime and get worse or get better. Is that true, or can you be born and then develop autism later on?
There isn't any evidence that for an acquired type of autism, okay, where you would be born with a neurotypical mind and brain and become autistic because of things that happen to you.
Yeah.
It is the case that adverse life circumstances can affect how a child functions socially and in terms of communication and so on. But I think a clinician can distinguish what is due to adverse life circumstances and what is due to a neurodivergent condition like ADHD or autism. It is true that if you're autistic and you have adverse life circumstances, your well-being will be affected. It's not clear whether your autistic traits will be exacerbated, but if you're living under stress, your social functioning isn't going to be better for sure.
Is there any link between being an older mother or having older parents, having an autistic child, or is there no proven correlation?
There is some evidence for a small effect of paternal age, actually father's age, more strongly than mother's age, on probability of autism, but also of most other neurodevelopmental conditions. So I don't think it's very specific to autism, but there is a weak effect of paternal age and some evidence maybe for maternal age too.
We had someone asking a personal question. We had a few personal questions. My son has autism and attends a weekly social group at school. Are social groups still recommended to help with social skills?
This is an interesting question. So the work that we've done on camouflaging and masking in autism, that is the way that autistic people tell us they try to blend in and appear less autistic, typically because they've been bullied and ostracized for showing their autistic traits, that work has made me feel a bit different about social skills groups. So for as long as I've been working in autism, there have been attempts to teach social skills to autistic children and young people. And there is a place for helping autistic people to understand how neurotypical people function. We talk about the double empathy problem, that we don't understand autistic people well and autistic people don't understand neurotypical people very well. So there's work to be done about translation. But what I do feel is that we risk, unless we're careful, we risk when we talk to somebody in a social skills group, we risk telling them, in effect, you're broken and you're wrong, and the way that you do social is wrong, and you need to do it my way, my neurotypical way. And that's a very bad message. And that leads to the pressure to mask, and that leads to poor self-esteem and all the negative consequences we often see in autism. So I think the model we need to have is more around second language learning. So if I go to a French class, the French teacher isn't going to tell me English is a terrible language, you must never speak it again, you must only speak French. English is a broken language, French is a good language, do this. And in the same way, we should be able to teach social skills in a way that is saying how you do social as an autistic person is fine. How non-autistic people, neurotypical people do social is different. And you might like to know how to do it that way, because like learning a second language, it will open some opportunities to you. It will let you go places and talk to people effectively in a way that your own language might make it more difficult. But respecting that the autistic way of doing things isn't wrong, but is different.
You mentioned there was a question about a charity who were looking to cure it. And if you could say a bit more about that and why that is a wrong position to take.
Yes. So the dialogue historically and still in some parts of the world is around curing autism, defeating autism. And autism isn't a disease. It's not something that needs to be cured. And the self-advocates who argue for disability rights and respect for neurodivergence are absolutely right in saying that it would be as inappropriate to talk about curing autism now as it was for psychiatrists not too long ago to talk about curing homosexuality, for example. So we recognize autism as a neurodivergence, a different way of thinking and processing the world. And the effort then is around supporting autistic people to live the best life that they can live, to increasing public understanding so that autistic people don't have to mask and hide and aren't bullied, and to help autistic people to, as I say, fulfill their potential, while respecting that a lot of autistic people have additional challenges that do need support and may need cure. Those aren't parts of autism. But epilepsy, for example, we'd certainly like a cure for. Depression and anxiety that are hugely common in autism. Nobody wants those left alone. Everybody would like treatment for those. And a child who has little language or no form of communication needs a form of communication. And that's an absolutely valid treatment target. But we don't anymore think that autism itself is a treatment target.
Do you think the proposed subcategory of profound autism is helpful or harmful?
That's interesting. So I understand that people want to have this label profound autism to designate part of the autism spectrum where individuals have additional intellectual disability, often language and communication difficulties. They may have minimal spoken language. And they may have additional challenges, may have self-injury and other kinds of difficulties. And I absolutely understand that the parents of young or older children like that feel left out of a picture of autism that on the media is often some media star coming forward and saying, I've got an autism diagnosis now. Somebody who is functioning extremely well, at least on the surface. And the parent whose child doesn't speak, it has multiple profound needs, doesn't feel included in that notion of autism. So, in fact, Lorna Wing, who was one of the founding grandmothers of autism research in this country and had an autistic daughter, Susie, who had very high support needs, she introduced the term Asperger's syndrome, which we may talk about later, in order to delineate again part of the autism spectrum. She didn't think it was different from autism, but the anecdote she gives, if you don't mind, I think is informative here. So Lorna said to me that she thought that Asperger's syndrome was a useful label, and she gave the example of going to a parent support group, an autism parent support group, and one parent saying, I was up all night with my son. He's so depressed. He was telling me about how he doesn't have any friends at school and he's really miserable and he's worried about his future and will he always be alone? And then the parent next door said, I just wished my child could speak. And she said those two parents couldn't support each other. They had completely different worries and concerns. And that was part of her rationale for saying, well, Asperger's syndrome as a label is useful. Then we know we can have an Asperger support group and the parents there will be able to support each other. So in that spirit, I understand the desire, the need to delineate. My child has high support needs. I'm not sure the word profound is helpful because it suggests that the autism is stronger, realer, deeper in those individuals than in another individual who doesn't have intellectual disability. And I don't happen to believe that. I don't think that autism and intellectual disability are woven together. And I think that you can be very autistic and very clever. You can be very autistic and have an intellectual disability. You can have milder or, paler shades of autism with an intellectual disability and paler shades of autism with high intellectual ability. So I think that they're orthogonal. Yeah. But I do understand the need to delineate the kinds of needs that a child or adult has.
There are a lot of nuances.
Mm.
Yeah.
And actually, the autism self-advocates do not want the autism spectrum chopped up into pieces.
Yeah.
They very much feel we're all in it together and we're stronger together. Mm. But I do understand that for particularly some parents of children with high support needs, it can be very frustrating the way that the media tends to portray autism these days.
Mm. It may be coming from a good faith, being that what they're trying to do is just, they're trying to say that this person might need different needs than others.
So I would talk about autism with high support needs.
Yeah.
In the DSM-5, the clinician should specify the level of support that the child or adult needs. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about it, because also that will ebb and flow over time, of course.
This question was the most liked question that we had. The way that we ask for questions is through an app called Slido, where you can ask your question. No registration is required during the lecture as you're watching it. And you can like them, and then they go further up the table so that our moderator can see them. What do we know about autistic women's experience of menopause?
So not very much is the short answer, but people are studying it now. And anecdotally, autistic women have certainly told me that for some of them, the hormonal changes during menopause feel to them that it is exacerbating the difficulties that they had already. And of course, it is a time of change. And we know that a lot of autistic people find change difficult. It's a time of uncertainty, and uncertainty is difficult for a lot of autistic and non-autistic people. But because it's a female-only experience, it's been neglected, as has the experience of pregnancy, for example, or the onset of periods and so on. So all of these female-only experiences have been neglected because we've also neglected autistic females historically in terms of research. But it is beginning to be addressed now.
I was thinking about reflections with puberty, and maybe that's a change, a biological change that you can't avoid. Yes. Is there a similarity between that then? Do autistic people struggle with going through puberty, for example?
Again, it hasn't been studied as it needs to be studied, but anecdotally, yes, definitely. And in particular for girls, and for some boys too, there's a sort of perfect storm that happens where primary school was maybe okay, you could cope with that. Mm. And then when you go to secondary school, you're coping with hormonal changes, puberty, a great big school and complex, you know, negotiating different places and spaces, sensory onslaught, typically a noisier, busier place, and more complex social situations and relationships. And that's often when either the autism becomes obvious and a diagnosis is sought, or unfortunately when a child breaks down and just can't cope anymore.
Do you think that some of the egos of autism theory, for example, Leo Kanner or Bettelheim, hampered our understanding of autism by taking us down rabbit holes?
Well, Bettelheim, of course, was completely unhelpful, to put it mildly, because he suggested that autism was psychogenic, that it was caused by refrigerator parenting, bad experiences, which is just wrong, it's false. It may be that some of the children that he saw were the children, as we've talked about, who have had adverse life experiences and whose social and behavioral functioning is affected by that, rather than by a neurodivergent condition. But that was a complete red herring. And it took a long time to get away from that mistaken view. And of course, Leo Kanner, having initially believed autism to be absolutely organic, was persuaded by that psychogenic view and was a proponent of the refrigerator mother notion. And it took root very powerfully in a number of places and still to some extent is influential in countries where psychoanalysis is predominant. So in France, for example, still a little bit of that flavor of, well, what did you do? Did you want the baby, etc.? And it took Michael Rutter, who I'm proud to say had the office next to me for many, many years and was the director of the center that I work in. It took his twin studies in the 1970s to disprove the psychogenic refrigerator mother theory. So yes, in that sense, they went down absolutely disastrous rabbit holes. On the other hand, Leo Kanner, Hans Asperger, and before either of them, Gwynya Sukareva described autism and noticed that there were children who had this syndrome, this cluster of features. And so for that, we have to be grateful.
In some ways, these theories that we have from the 19th century and before, old theories that we can disprove now, some of them, sometimes you can see them as helpful because what they're doing is they're highlighting the obvious things that are wrong about it. And then you can focus on that and more focus on other parts of research, which might help us in understanding it better, possibly. We now move on to our question about Asperger's. Can you talk more about the concept of Asperger's and how it's changed recently?
So as I mentioned, Lorna Wing introduced the term Asperger's syndrome for that part of the autism spectrum where an individual has social and communication differences and difficulties, rigid and repetitive traits, just like autism, but doesn't have language problems or cognitive intellectual difficulties. And it really grew up as a distinct diagnosis, because historically, language impairment had been seen as absolutely fundamental to autism. So Lorna Wing's generation and Mike Rutter's generation, the children who were being diagnosed had little or no language. They certainly had a profound language delay. And to some extent, parents and clinicians thought, well, if only we could give them language, then they wouldn't have the difficulties they have. It's because they don't have language, they don't have there's something about symbolic thinking that they don't have. Some of those children, of course, after their language delay, did develop language. And it was a mystery, to some extent, to the people of that time, why they still had social and communication difficulties and rigid and repetitive behavior. And then the next stage was that people noticed there were some children who didn't even have a language delay. They were speaking at the time you'd expect them to. Maybe what they said was a bit eccentric, but they were speaking well. They didn't have a language problem. And for that set of researchers and thinkers, that really was incredibly surprising. And so Asperger's syndrome was included in the diagnostic manual, DSM-4, as a research diagnosis in order to find out, are these children different? Because, gosh, this is really surprising. We've got these kids. They look autistic. They didn't have a language delay. We need to know if they're different. Is this a different syndrome? Is it part of the same thing? Lorna introduced the term Asperger's syndrome because the children that Hans Asperger described, many of them were of that type. They had good language, good intellectual functioning. What happened? Why didn't we keep it? Well, people did an enormous amount of research looking at whether those children who didn't have a language delay were different in their prognosis or in their development or in their functioning from children who did have a language delay. And it turned out that as long as you matched those two groups for their verbal IQ, for their verbal ability at the time that you're looking at them, there really wasn't any big difference. So there wasn't a good rationale for keeping it as a separate diagnosis, because the only way to keep it as a separate diagnosis would be to say, well, we have autism defined by social and communication difficulties, rigid and repetitive traits. And then we have Asperger syndrome defined by social and communication difficulties, rigid and repetitive traits, and a lack of language problems and a lack of cognitive or intellectual disability. But language and intellectual disability aren't part of the autism diagnosis. So how would that be different? So in the end, we wrapped Asperger syndrome into the autism spectrum disorder wider label that came into DSM-5. And at the time, there was quite a lot of resistance to that. And there were people, I remember going to meet autism self-advocate leader, and my now husband saying to me at the time, are you going to be okay? Is he likely to gun you down because this is such an unpopular move? And actually, in the conversation with him, he was very in favor of it, interestingly, because while many people were saying, but Asperger's syndrome is my identity, you can't take it away from me. Mm. He was saying, I want us all to be one spectrum. Yeah. And I don't want people to be turned away from services because they're told, oh, you only have Asperger's syndrome, you don't need us, or you can't access my service because you've got autism, we're only for Asperger's syndrome. And the other thing that was a nail in the coffin, from my point of view, was people writing to us and saying, but Asperger's syndrome doesn't have any stigma, and autism has a stigma, so you must keep Asperger's syndrome. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The idea is that nobody, none of these labels have a stigma. Yeah. So I think we did the right thing. Yeah. It was hair-raising at the time. And then, of course, subsequently, there has been quite a lot of debate and concern about whether Hans Asperger was complicit in the Nazi eugenics and the destruction of children and adults with handicaps of various sorts. And so I think the popularity of the term has taken, to put it mildly, a knock.
Why do we not hear about diet and the GFCF anymore in treatment for autism, GFCF being gluten-free, casein-free? Many of the children we treat suffer terribly with diet restrictions, so I think this is a question from someone who works in the autism field.
I think that there haven't been really good randomized controlled trials that show the benefits of a restricted diet in autism. Now, part of that may be that we know that autism is very heterogeneous. Biologically, it's heterogeneous. And it may be that we're mixing apples and oranges in those kinds of trials. And if we could identify the subgroup for whom there is real food intolerance, then we would see a benefit. It's obviously going to be true that if you are uncomfortable, if you've got gut problems, if you've got constipation, then whatever behavioral difficulties you have are going to be exacerbated, are going to be more obvious. And I would make a really strong point that for children and adults who have very little language, who can't tell you about what's going on with them, if their behavior changes radically, you should always investigate pain. Pain might very well be the explanation. And so that's very important to know. And gastrointestinal pain is one of those categories. But I think there used to be a notion that actually being poisoned by your diet was causing autism. And that doesn't have any strong support in the research to date. So people certainly look at different kinds of diets and restricted diets as they would for anybody. Lots of people are intolerant of or feel better when they cut out milk or whatever, gluten. But it doesn't seem to be something that we know, understand as being integral to autism, although gastrointestinal problems do seem to be. And some of that may be to do with the very restricted diet, which is also mentioned in that question. So a lot of autistic children and adults like to eat only a very few things. That may be to do with texture as much as to do with taste. So very bland food, people talk about a grey diet or beige diet. And obviously, that can be problematic in terms of intestinal health. So these things are complicated and very individual. So obviously, with advice, with medical advice, parents should feel able to explore different kinds of diets as long as they're healthy.
Thank you. We come to our last question we had, and it's a question which has come from all of the podcasts I've done before. I think everyone, all the podcasts I've done recently have asked about AI. So this is a question about AI. What is your views on using AI for the diagnosis of ASD?
Well, people are certainly looking into it. So people are using AI to read brain scans, for example. And I think it's too early to tell what we're going to find out. That's probably true in the answer to all the AI questions. In the end, the diagnosis is behavioral. And in the end, although we have various instruments and standard, semi-standard interviews and observation schedules and things, in the end, it always comes down to the clinician's judgment is gold standard. People are looking at whether things like motion capture, would it be helpful during a diagnosis to be measuring eye gaze, pupil dilation, body language, and would that somehow improve diagnostic accuracy? And maybe for the groups where our diagnosis we don't think is very good, so that would be some autistic women who mask a lot, some autistic men who mask a lot, the elderly and very young children, maybe it will help. But on the other hand, if you can't pick up the behavioral difference, is it helpful to label someone? So interestingly, we used, before AI, we used to think about this in terms of genetic markers. So we can get a genetic propensity score for autism, which tells you how many of the many, many alleles, all of small effect somebody has that are relevant to autism. But it doesn't work at an individual level. It works for research to say, well, you know, here's a group with a lot of the relevant genes, here's a group with very few of the relevant genes. But it's not at the level that you could identify, is this person autistic based on their genome? But before we knew that, we used to wonder, well, when we know the genes, won't it be interesting as a thought experiment if you have somebody who has autism genetically but doesn't look autistic in the sense of doesn't have social and communication difficulties, isn't rigid and repetitive, are we going to say they're autistic or not? Because it's a behavioral diagnosis. So in the same way, to some extent, with the AI, if the AI picked up something and said, this is autism, but everybody around the person, including the person themselves, said, you're not autistic. I'm not autistic. I don't feel different. I don't have any difficulty knowing what you're thinking and interacting. What will we do with that? Because autism is a behavioral diagnosis.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Francesca. Your lecture is now available to watch on YouTube, and it's been available for quite some time. And we have had lots and lots of comments from people who have watched that lecture. And a lot of those comments are from people with autism or people who know people with autism who have found that lecture incredibly helpful. So lots and lots of positive comments. So thank you very much for sending those in. I'm just going to pick one out, which touched me and thought and encapsulated how important your lecture was for our audience. As an autistic woman, this was by far the most accessible, actually informative, and most humane discussion of autism I've ever joined. Thank you. So thank you, Francesca, for joining me. There are two other lectures in the Neurodiversity series, which you can watch also. One is by Peter Hill on ADHD, and the other is by Maggie Snowling, who talks about dyslexia. So do go and watch them now. Thank you, Francesca, and thank you at home for listening.
Thank you, Richard.